This ESPN Radio Daily Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. To get a free quote on car insurance, call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive. This is the ESPN Radio Daily Podcast.
Tim Hasovic, one of our NFL analysts, hanging out with us on set and doing double duty, so we appreciate that. Now, let's get to what is the most rumored deal now that Peppers is done and in Chicago, and that's Brandon Marshall with the Denver Broncos. Supreme talent, probably one of the top three wide receivers in the league.
Easily make that argument.
Well, he's a first-round tender, which means if you're another team and you want to sign him, he can sign an offer sheet with you, and then Denver can either match that contract or say, you know what, you take him, we'll just bring back your first rounder. Now, Seattle, who loves to add those receivers for your brother.
I don't know if they love having them for him, but they definitely wouldn't mind. You know, we mentioned Jeremy Bates a little bit earlier.
Sure.
Jeremy Bates, the offensive coordinator in Seattle, was at USC with Pete Carroll last year, but before that was the offensive coordinator in Denver. Mike Shanahan was letting him call the plays in Denver. Had a great relationship with Jay Cutler, but also loves Brandon Marshall.
Okay, so Brandon Marshall, and the rumor is that he is going to perhaps visit Seattle tomorrow, and that the quote was that Seattle's absolutely looking at doing this deal. Now, Seattle has two first-round draft picks.
Right.
They have the number 6 pick, and they have the number 14 pick. They'd have to give up the number 6 pick if they sign Marshall, and Denver says, okay, fine, now we'll take your pick back. The ironic thing is Seattle has that number 14 pick because of a trade they did last year where Denver traded their 2010 first-rounder for the number 5 pick in the second round from Seattle last year. So that's worked out for Seattle. Let's just look at it from Seattle's standpoint.
Yes.
What does Brandon Marshall bring to your team if we look at the entire package?
Well, I think looking at the entire package, starting with Brandon Marshall on the football field, and you're talking about the 6th pick. If you knew with the 6th overall pick, you were getting Brandon Marshall, who could be, as you said, and I agree with you, a top three wide receiver, a guy that will block for you, a guy that's got tremendous run after the catch, a guy who can run vertical routes, a guy who can run option routes, a guy who can go up and get the football in the red zone, a guy that actually dictates coverage from the defense. They will play him differently than they'll play anybody, any other receivers in the National Football League, with the exception of maybe 5 or 6 guys. He absolutely is worth it on the field. Now, there's off-the-field baggage. That's just part of the deal, and you have to take that into consideration. And you know, I don't know how they'll feel about it, but I do know, as we mentioned, Jeremy Bates knows this guy, you know, and so he knows, is it immaturity or is he a bad guy? You know, I mean, and that's probably the discussions that are going on and what it comes down to.
Coaches, fans, owners definitely can talk themselves into overlooking any of those negatives when we're talking about rare talent. That's what you have with Brandon Marshall, but as a guy who played in the league and, you know, played this sport for a long time, I'm curious, would you rather have a teammate who competed, who cared about winning, and brought it on game day, but didn't take care of himself off the field, hung around with the wrong crew, and there was always a worry that there's going to be a call at 3 in the morning, or a guy where you never worried about the off-the-field stuff, but just really liked the paycheck and didn't really care all that much whether or not he won or lost?
Well, I think there's a... Look, you want the guy who's a pro. I would rather have, you know, I used to use
this
example.
You're not picking an option I didn't give you.
No. But I would, I'm going to do that. I'm going to play the middle card here. But here's what I used to say. When I was with the Giants, David Tyree was a teammate of mine, and he was a guy that physically didn't really, I mean, he was an overachiever as a wide receiver, with a doubt. Plaxico Burress was there. I would have rather had 11 David Tyrees than 11 Plaxico Burress, or 2 Plaxico Burress. I would much rather the guy that you can count on. Now, with that being said, I'm not positive that Brandon Marshall's a guy that you can't count on. You know, I mean, I think there's some question about it, but I'm not so sure it's one of those things where you know that he can't do it. And remember, Brandon Marshall, you know, a lot of what's happened with him is that there's a lot of talk about him wanting this new contract and, you know, people having a problem with that. Put yourself in his shoes. You're a fourth-round pick. You've maybe made about $2.5 million throughout your NFL career, okay? To most people, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about him as a top-three wide receiver, okay? So he's in the mix with Larry Fitzgerald and Andre Johnson. Larry Fitzgerald has probably made about $60 million and put up similar production to Brandon Marshall. Andre Johnson has probably made about $45 million and about the same type of production as Brandon Marshall. Brandon Marshall made $2.5 million. Brandon Marshall has every right to say, I outplayed this rookie deal, pay me more money. Now,
yeah,
the
well,
off-field stuff.
He has every right to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I'm in the group where it's like, if the Seahawks are my favorite team.
Right.
And I'd want an autograph from your brother. But I'd be like, hey, done. Give me Brandon Marshall. I don't care. Cause he's awesome. But if you're an owner and you're like, hey, I want to give this guy $30 million guaranteed, it's like I can give the guy Larry Fitzgerald to wear his ascots off the field, mm-hmm. or I can give him to Brandon Marshall, who's been arrested a handful of times. The resume is not impressive there. And I usually overlook that stuff, and I kind of do in a way that I'll talk about earlier and talk about again. I can understand him being frustrated, but can he ever look in the mirror and go, I kind of brought it on myself?
No, listen, I agree with you, because the only difference between those guys... As you mentioned, Larry Fitzgerald, he's a friend of mine. He's a great guy. I mean, absolute great guy. I don't know Andre Johnson.
I was complimenting
but
the ascot.
You never,
look,
he is a pretty good dresser.
Yeah,
I will give
him
that. But Andre Johnson, I don't know him personally, but you never hear of any kind of drama with him off the field. You hear about what a great teammate he is. So, listen, that's the only thing that separates. So you're right. I get it. But with that being said, I think there's plenty of people in terms of public perception on Brandon Marshall is, how could he want this new contract? Well, it's like, that's exactly how you do it. I mean, again,
it's not just a guy who did a deal and got paid a ton of money and decided, hey, I want to redo it a year later.
In comparison to people who have produced the way he has made nothing in terms of money in the National Football League.
Tim Hasselbeck, Ryan Russillo, Scott Van Pelt show on ESPN Radio. If you're watching on ESPN2, you see the graphic Brandon Marshall. Last three seasons combined, over 300 catches, second only to Wes Welker in the NFL. Who knows? He could be a Seahawk by this time tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Final thought that I want to finish with. Who's the name? Who's the guy that you're looking for to make another splash? I mean, Peppers was the marquee guy. You've talked about Carlos Dansby. Mm-hmm. We've hit on Brandon Marshall. But who's the next guy that you think could really make that big impact that you're waiting on?
I don't know that there necessarily is that guy. Look at all the guys that would be, because of the uncertainty with the CBA, and these guys that would be unrestricted guys that aren't. I mean, go down the list. I mean, Brandon Marshall guy, but Miles Austin, Sean Merriman, all those guys.
All tender.
They're just, and now those guys are restricted. So they're not free to necessarily go make that splash. So you bring it down a notch to that. Oh, man. Look, Carlos Dansby is a guy, quite honestly, I thought Chester Taylor was the best running back available, but the next guy I would say would be Thomas Jones.
Well, let's just stop there then and finish with this thought. How bad are your former NFL brethren going to hit this offseason? Because it doesn't look good. I was looking at the other day, 60 guys in their 20s that are unrestricted free agents.
Here's the thing, and guys can't be mad because this is what everyone signed off on. I mean, they can't be mad about it.
Well, they can't be mad when the salary cap goes up almost $50 million.
I don't know that everyone totally understood it, which is why you see all these guys complaining, tweeting about it and talking to reporters about how they're furious that they got tendered, And it's like, look, no one's going to feel bad for you that you got tendered, even though, you're missing out on this big payday that you would have gotten had the rules not played out the way they did. But listen, this could be a very interesting situation, because think about this. You got a lot of guys complaining about tenders that are going to pay them $3.1 million. What's going to happen, again, not to get ahead of ourselves, but a year from now if it's talk about not playing football?
Right, because you're not going to get tendered when you're not playing.
You're absolutely right.
Good stuff, man. Thank you so much.
Yep.
To compare car insurance rates from top insurers in one easy place, visit Progressive.com today. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive.
Dodger great Oral Hershiser via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. By the way, named to the Sunday Night Baseball booth. First off, congrats to being in the Sunday
Night. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. Next. All right. As a pitcher, what is too much celebration? What would rankle you, Oral?
Staring at home plate. Every action gets somebody upset. It gets the pitcher upset. It gets your teammates upset. It gets your manager or your pitching coach upset. It gets somebody upset around the team. So it's not always a personal thing that the retribution or the payback comes from. It can be a team thing or a coach thing. It comes from everywhere. It really does. But when it's personal, right against the pitcher, or the pitcher really feels like he stared too long, he stayed in the box too long, he did too many little dances around each base, once he crossed home plate, he looked back at me. there, then that gets a little bit worse. But sometimes it even gets stirred up from other people on the team.
Well, yeah, I mean, yesterday, I mean, Barry Zito, do you think it's, do you think 6 months later, people are emailing me this morning, Oral, come on, it's 6 months later, get over it. But does
that's short-term. That's short-term in baseball. That's short-term. Because this is a league that you don't just play against these guys 1 year. You play, you know, 3 and 4 and 5 generations play together in the big leagues. You play little league, you play against those guys for a little bit, and then you change neighborhoods or something. You play high school, you play against those guys once a year, and all of a sudden you're not on varsity anymore, you move on. You play in college, you may play against them a couple times. You finally get to the big leagues, you play against people for 15, 20 years. So no, 6 months is not very long in that culture.
You think
that could last 4 or 5 years? That could last their whole career.
Were you ever told to hit somebody?
Oh boy, that would pin it back onto my manager. So I have to say no. Fortunately, I played for more than one manager, but everybody was related back to a little chubby guy that wore a Dodger uniform, and that would be wrong. So
yeah.
No, I've never been told.
Fair enough. I think you're dodging it. But listen, Joe Torre said,
no, I'm not dodging it. Yes, I've been told.
Yeah,
you're not told you need to hit this guy. You're told something needs to be done, or you glance down the bench and go, Bulldog. Yeah, I got it. All right.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, it's just understood. And if you don't do it, you might have a problem with the opposing player or the opposing team, but that's better than having a problem with your own team and your own manager.
Absolutely right.
You know, you have to live with those people. You have family, and then you have friends, acquaintances, and enemies on the other side. And so I don't want to have a problem with my family.
I asked Joe Torre earlier this hour. Now the Phillies have upgraded with Roy Halladay, and the Dodgers don't have what many believe to be an ace, although they've got a lot of twos. Do you have to have an ace to beat the Yankees or the Phillies?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Joe has to say it because he's got young pitchers that are hoping to grow to be into aces. And you have to be within the culture of the media and protect your team and what your roster and Ned Coletti. But Joe's a very smart man, and if you get into the playoffs, you want to have that stopper, that ace. You know, you try and get people to have the mentality of being the ace every night to take the mound. But in general, you want that stopper in the regular season to stop the losing streaks, to go up against the other guy that really can put it on you. And in the playoffs, the matchups are so specific. So, yeah, you need somebody that can go out there and give up 2 runs or less in 7 innings, give your bullpen a chance, and give your offense a chance.
You know, I said this during the World Series last year. I think you can make an argument the Phillies roster is better than the Yankees. Now, it comes down to pitching in the postseason. I love the Phillies roster. I think it's just loaded full of great baseball players. You go player to player, who do you like better? And I'm not just talking, you know, obviously CeCe was just unbelievable in the series. Who do you like better, Phillies or Yankees roster?
I'm right with you. I like the Phillies. You know, the Utley Rollins stuff. Rollins is the weak link, even though he's the big name. Ryan Howard is streaky, but he comes through now, and he's really maturing as a hitter. He used to put up the stats, and you'd say the stats could come from a hot week and then a hot month, and then he'd get cold for a while, and everybody worry about it. You can't hit the breaking ball, he'd be chasing it. But now it seems like Ryan's stats come consistently throughout the year, just the way they lay on the map. Utley's off the charts. Victorino's going to be down there in the 8-hole. Give me a break. Polanco, Hill, and the bat up there in the 2-hole now, or wherever he's going to be. It's an all-star lineup to go through, and they play in a bandbox. So they have the type of pitching that can pitch in that ballpark, and then they have that type of hitting that can take advantage of it. It's a scary place to go into now as an opposing team, and so are the Yankees. But the Yankees have to hope that, you know, Curtis Granderson is really who he is, that Brett Gardner can really do his thing, that Nick Johnson. So you don't see 3 question marks on the Yankee or on the Philly roster like you do on the Yankee roster.
You are preparing for your new Sunday Night Baseball role. You're a former Dodger.
Right.
We talked about Vin Scully, I swear, for a half hour today. I grew up listening to Scully. I think Scully's the greatest that's ever done it. Have you ever heard Scully talk about you pitching? Have you ever gone back and heard the tapes?
Sometimes, yeah. When you go back and you can't believe that you threw 59 scoreless, you want to go back and see if somebody really did score a run, so you have to hear his voice. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I think he's absolutely unbelievable. But the guy I'm going to work next to this year, John Miller, you know, he gets the Hall of Fame award from Ford, the Frick Award, and I think, you know, there are people in your life that you would like to receive bad news from twice just to hear them say it. And I think Vince Scully, John Miller, those kind of people are like, you know, I'm going to bite your head off and I'm going to spit down your throat. Oh, please say it again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
that sounds great.
Yeah. John Miller and Vin Scully, I said this, they wake up interesting. They just have stories to tell and they're both unbelievable. Former Dodger great Oral Hershiser via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Good talking to you and good luck.
All right. I love your show. I think you're amazing.
Thanks, bud.
All right. Take care.
All right. Oral Hershiser.
Speaking of the dance, let's bring in our college basketball analyst extraordinaire. Here's Jay Billis on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. And, you know, Jay, sort of the old school bid for the Ivy League, one of the few left that still don't play that postseason conference tournament and let the regular season champion get in. I understand that these postseason tournaments for these conferences generate a lot of money and that money is necessary. But boy, you sit back and look at it logically standpoint, it sure does seem to make a lot more sense to reward the team that's been the best in the conference over 2 months.
Yeah, and the conferences, Greeny, get to choose how they give out their automatic bid. You know, they can do it like the Ivy does it and have the regular season champion. They can have a tournament and have the tournament champion. They can arm wrestle if they want to. But, you know, when I was at the Duke-Maryland game the other night, I was talking about that with Mike Krzyzewski, and he's advocating that regular season champions have automatic bids into the NCAA tournament as well as if we do that expansion, if the NCAA goes to 96 teams. And, you know, it's a fair point, but, you know, then you start getting into automatic bids for everybody. And holy cow, I couldn't think of a conference champion, a regular season champion that wasn't invited to the tournament. And if they weren't, then you'd probably make a pretty good case that they weren't that good in the first place. I just couldn't recall one that hadn't been invited.
Jay, who are a few teams out there that need at least a couple of wins in their conference tournament in the bigger conferences to get an invite?
You know, Mike, I think teams like Louisville, Dayton, you know, I think Rhode Island needs to do that as well. There's some teams at the Atlantic 10 that looked awfully good a month ago and as safe as you can look. I think teams like Oklahoma State have to continue to win. And we've talked about this before. I think it's a weak field at the end of the line. So I don't think that it's going to take much to get in or to be bounced out. And there are going to be teams like you could make a pretty darn good case with the amount of win, just by wins alone. I'm not talking about if you forget everybody's losses and you looked at the quality of teams beaten. Heck, Georgia's beaten more good teams than some of these other teams out there that we're talking about on the bubble. Problem is they've lost too many games. But for me, when I think about teams that you're letting in in the very last teams getting in, I'm more concerned with who they've been able to beat rather than who they've lost to, because all of them have proven they can lose. But to me, you know, the bubble teams aren't going to play bad teams. It's not like you have to worry about them getting stumbling over a bad team. They're only going to play good teams. The only teams that get to play bad teams in the NCAA tournament are the 1 and 2 seeds. You know, everybody else has to play good teams. So if you're a bubble team and you've proven you can knock off big shots, that catches my eye more than anything else.
Mike and Mike, Jay Billis is with us here on ESPN Radio. You mentioned Louisville in the Big East. How about Notre Dame in Connecticut? We made a big deal about their game on Wednesday night. Or two, whatever night that was, they played two.
Yeah, Wednesday night.
Well, when Notre Dame beat Connecticut for the second time this year, but UConn still hanging their hat on two things, the three big wins and also the fact that they did lose some of their games this year without their head coach. Those two teams, what would you consider their status?
You know, I think they're still bubble teams that have to continue to win. I don't think anybody in their position can afford to lose and get bounced out of a tournament early and still make it in. You're giving yourself a real hurdle to get over in the selection process. I don't think that Wednesday was an elimination game like some people were saying. I think that UConn is still in decent shape to make it. They've still got opportunities to get in. And because the sort of the bubble field is historically weak, I just don't think it's going to take that much. You know, if they win again, we're going to feel a lot differently about them than after they lost at Notre Dame. It's kind of this thing where if a team loses, you wonder how they're going to make it, and if a team wins, you wonder how we're going to keep them out. So you know, this is the last audition that all these teams have, and the best recommendation you can give to a team is keep winning, because there's no magic number that they can reach in number of wins or number of quality wins to make anybody feel comfortable if they're in that position right now.
Mike and Mike, Jay Billis is with us here. One of the things that, as an alumnus of a Big Ten school, one of the things that has always frustrated me is the Big Ten decided to take the money and play that late championship game on Sunday on CBS. The Big Ten always plays their conference championship game. It usually ends right up against the selection show. And this year, that could really be a factor, Jay, because it is my opinion that if Ohio State wins the Big Ten conference tournament, they have a legitimate case to be made to be a number one seed, especially if Duke doesn't win the ACC. How do they handle something like that?
Well, they're going to have to mess with the seed lines and make sure that they can move one or two teams.
Well, do you agree with me? If Ohio State wins the Big Ten, do they have a? I think they have a pretty good argument to be a number one seed.
I do, but if they get into the final, I think they'd have a pretty good argument to be a number one seed. The only thing that would keep them out of it, out of that discussion would be the time that Evan Turner was out, and that's one of the things I wrote about the other day. You know, we're sitting here talking about, well, Jim Calhoun was out for this period of time, so UConn should get a little bit of a break, and Luke Herangode out if he comes back, Notre Dame, you got to wonder about Austin Freeman, Georgetown. Nobody's ever said anything about Evan Turner. You know, Evan Turner's the best player in the country, and he was out for six games with a broken bone in his back, and his team lost some games. They would not have lost at Butler. With all due respect to Butler, that's an outstanding basketball team, but they would not have lost to Butler if they had Evan Turner, especially the way they were playing at the time. So I agree with you. I think, you know, I have Ohio State in the power rankings this week that we do on ESPN.com. I have them number four, and that would equate to a number one seed. And if they do win the Big Ten outright, they've already won a share, and if they win the Big Ten tournament, then they're the conference champion without question. I agree with you. Number one seed is absolutely in order.
Mike and Mike, Jay Billis is with us. And coming up, speaking of tournaments, we got a shot, Mike. I think we put this together. Jay is getting set for the 2010 Hoop It Up 3-on-3 basketball tournament. Jay, what do you think? You, me, and Golic, we enter. I think we're a lock.
Yeah, if Golic sets screens and we can find somebody for you to guard, I think we can do that. You know, you guys, I don't know if you've played in this tournament. I have. Hoop It Up is the premier 3-on-3 tournament in the country. And, you know, this year it's being sponsored by Shamrock Farms Rockin' Refuel Chocolate Milk, and it's benefiting something that you guys have done an extraordinary job, I think, in shepherding, and that is the fight against cancer. You've done an extraordinary job with the Jimmy V Foundation, and I've been tied in. I'm on the national board of Coaches Versus Cancer, and you know, Shamrock Farms Rockin' Refuel is donating $10 for every team that enters the Hoop It Up 3-on-3 tournament to Coaches Versus Cancer and the American Cancer Society for the fight against cancer. It's in 33 cities around the country. You can go to rockandrefuel.com and find out where it's near you. And it is a great tournament. It's a great way to get out and compete, especially this time of year. And it benefits something that we all have a stake in. That's the fight against cancer. And you know, on behalf of Coaches Versus Cancer and everybody that has fought so hard, thank you guys for what you've done in this fight. You've been tremendous.
It's the very least we could do, and I certainly do think that if the three of us were to find a way to enter,
we could
be dangerous. No, we'd be dangerous.
Jeez.
He just said you setting screens. He'll get rebounds.
What are you going to do?
Just stroke the J, baby.
Like I said, we'd be out in Rome.
I can shoot the rock.
We'd be out early, but we could go to a local pub.
You know what? Good point.
And Golic will like the chocolate milk, so everything will be all right. Jay, terrific. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
That's Jay Billis with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. It's Subway Footlong Nation Appreciation. You could win free footlongs for a year. Official rules at SubwayFreshBuzz.com.
You think your ability in basketball is much better than it really is.
I've got game.
Remember, I played you in horse. I beat you on layups.
Horse is not basketball. Basketball is a game. Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone, so is Dr. J and Moses Malone.
Okay, all right, I'm done.
Okay.
Spring training games starting earlier this week. Always happy to talk to Rob Nyer, senior writer at ESPN.com. And, you know, Rob, as I watch these spring training games, and I know you don't see a whole lot in them, and you're only watching starters for just a couple of innings, it's amazing how my mind immediately goes to who's not there and some of the big-name players who still don't have jobs. And I had Jermaine Dye, Gary Sheffield, Jared Washburn, just a couple of these names of guys that just they can't seem to find work. Who finds work next, and what happens with these guys?
I think all of those guys will play again if they really want to play. A lot of times, the way that the stories are spun on players like them is that nobody wants them. Well, that isn't really the case. Nobody wants them for the price they want to play for. Jermaine Dye is not the player that he was. Gary Sheffield certainly isn't the player that he was. But both of those guys can still help somebody in a limited role. the question is, you know, they have to follow up pride. I mean, you talk about Jermaine Dye, who made a lot of money last year. And if he wants to play again, he's going to have to take a lot less money. And look, some players just don't want to do that, and I can understand it. Some players will come back, they don't care. They'll play for the minimum because they want to be out there. Some guys don't. And, you know, it's a personal decision, and I really couldn't fault a guy either way.
One of the things that's interesting about the group of especially hitters who are left, Dye, Sheffield, Hank Blaylock, is that they're all primarily power hitters, and we're now watching a game shift a little bit towards athleticism, towards speed, towards defense, and I got a few questions about that coming up here in a moment. But if all these shifts are about finding value, couldn't you now say you could actually amazingly find some value in a power hitter like a Jermaine Dye?
Yes, absolutely. I think the pendulum probably has swung a little too far, though we really won't know for sure until we see what Dye signs for, if he does sign with somebody. But I think that's right. I think that there has been a necessary correction away from power hitters who are defensive liabilities toward players who have defensive value. We saw a lot of that this winter and last winter as well. Teams really paying more attention to defense when it comes to placing a value on a player, looking at the whole player and not just how many home runs he hit or how many RBIs he had last year. That's a good thing. But as is often the case, there's probably been a bit of an overcorrection. So I think you're absolutely right. But another problem for those guys, though, is that in addition to not being good defensive players, teams are a little reluctant these days to sign a player just to be a DH. They like to hold that slot open so they can sort of rotate players in and out and give them a day off from the field. So Jermaine Dye, you know, look at a guy like Vladimir Guerrero. The Rangers have committed to Guerrero as their DH. Well, that's the sort of job that Jermaine Dye would best fill, but there aren't a lot of teams that want to do that.
Makes a lot of sense. Talking to Rob Nyer, senior writer of ESPN.com here on ESPN Radio. Rob, speaking of defense, at least three guys I can think of off the top of my head who may be shifting positions and going from somewhere else in the infield to third base for the first time this year. That's Placido Polanco, Miguel Tejada, and Jose Lopez are going to try the move from second to third as well. How tough a move is that, and how important is it for those three teams?
I don't think you can know until a player has done it. Clearly it's important, especially for the first two, because they're the full-time guys. Polanco actually played some third base early in his career and was quite good at it. I think he's going to be fine. I think you could put Polanco anywhere in the infield except shortstop, and he would be above average, and maybe even an average shortstop. I mean, he's older than he used to be, but he's a very talented player defensively, and I think he'll be fine. Tejada, I think, too, will be fine. For the most part, most shortstops can make that move. Not all, because it is a slightly different position. You know, it's more of a reaction position than shortstop is. The ground balls get there and the line drives a lot faster than they do at shortstop. But I think he'll be fine, too. Lopez, I mean, you know, they're not counting on him to be the everyday guy necessarily. I think he'll wind up being a utility guy and a pretty good one.
Interesting. As you talk about the Mariners, and of course I'm in Seattle right now, we got to spend some time today on Milton Bradley's comments about Chicago, and I'll read them to you. I know you wrote about it today as well. Milton Bradley, talking about Chicago today, says to the New York Times, 2 years ago I played and I was good. I go to Chicago, not good. I've been good my whole career, so obviously it was something with Chicago, not me. How do you react?
Well, as you know, what I wrote about that was not so much about Milton Bradley's comments, because they're not really, frankly, surprising. It sounds like something he would say. And they're preposterous, of course. I mean, yes, he was fantastic 2 years ago with Texas. And yes, he was not fantastic last year with the Cubs. But the running thread through his career is not that he's been a good player. It's that he's been a hurt player. And he was healthy with the Rangers. And he was not healthy last year, in part, perhaps, because the Cubs asked him to play in the outfield every day. That was the plan, anyways. That didn't work out. I don't think it'll work out with the Mariners either. But that, to me, that's the real issue, is how many games can Milton Bradley play? Because a lot of people are picking the Mariners are a very trendy pick to win the West for a lot of good reasons. But I still wonder where the runs are going to come from. Yes, they added Sean Figgins, but they lost Russell Branyan, who was so good last year in the first half. And I think that they're looking at Milton Bradley as a guy who can sort of fill that gap. Hit the middle of the order, score a lot of runs, drive in some runs, and I think he'll do that when he can play. I just don't know if he'll play 100 games.
Yeah. Sports Illustrated today, as we talked to Rob Nyer, ESPN.com, Sports Illustrated today ranked the general managers in baseball. In the top three, I believe, Andrew Friedman, Theo Epstein, Brian Cashman, those are the top three. Dayton Moore came in last on this list. Rather than getting into the rankings and fighting about them, I'll ask you just this. What does it take to be a good GM in 2010?
Well, I think two things. The most important thing, the two most important things that a general manager has to do is make smart moves. That's obvious. We all know that. And I think today it helps to have a familiarity with and also a friendliness with, for lack of a better word, modern statistical analysis, sabermetrics, we might call it. Some general managers are successful without that. The Twins, the Phillies, they don't spend a lot of time on that stuff. The Angels, they still do well. So you don't need that, but it helps, I think, these days, especially because you're competing against a number of general managers who do know their analysis. But also, and this is the stuff this is what's so hard to quantify, you've got to be able to manage this far-flung organization. You're responsible for hiring the scouting director, the director of player development, all the people who work for them, basically, you have to sign off on. You've got to have good people skills. It's an incredibly complicated job. And I think too many fans think it's just, Billy Bean on the phone making trades. It's a lot more than that. It's not surprising to me when some, intelligent, talented people fail in that job because it's a very specific skill set, and most people just don't have it.
Great stuff. Always good to talk to you. Rob Nyer, senior writer, ESPN.com. We'll do it again soon.
Sounds great. Take care, Mike.
Log on to ESPN.com/podcenter or ESPNradio.com for more great podcasts.